Good, for allowing us the opportunity. I'm Martine Delaney. I'm one of today's spokespeople for the what I will shall refer to as the TGLRG. It saves about 30 seconds every time we go through it. I'd start by simply saying that considering that in recent months we've had comments by the Prime Minister and a number of other ministers about the fact that they have dealt with discrimination against same-sex couples in federal government law. It's important, federal legislation, it's important to realise that they haven't, that apart from a couple of things about changes in Australian Defence Force policy rather than legislation, and one bit of legislation relating to private superannuation lump sum death benefits, they have done very little for Australia's same-sex couples. Just briefly, the Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group, of which we're a part, was formed in 1988 as part of the effort to reform Tasmania's quite repressive anti-gay legislation. And since that time, the TGLRG has played a significant part in assisting Tasmania to the forefront of legislative recognition of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex people. We now arguably have the most progressive discrimination and relationship legislation in the country, and along with the nation's only inclusive social plan process, Tasmania Together. And we're proud that the TGLRG has played a major part in that. In addition, we also contributed to policy development and implementation within a number of government agencies, Tasmanian government agencies, through participation in LGBTI reference groups. And also quite actively involved in national LGBTI issues. Our submission really relates not to, well, it doesn't in fact relate at all to specific stories of discrimination experienced by Tasmanians. We've looked at the issues in relation to legislation and done that, looking at the inquiries, examination of Australia's compliance with three particular United Nations conventions: the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the Discrimination in Employment and Occupation Convention of 1958. Now, we go back one step further than that and note that each of these conventions takes its mandate from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which begins with the words that whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the very foundation of freedom, justice and peace in the world. And from this we can only conclude that any Australian law which does not ensure equal access and treatment to same-sex couples is in breach of both the Universal Declaration and the conventions relating to this inquiry. Okay, I'm sorry, my mind's just gone temporarily blank. I'll be back in a moment. As part of this submission, and I won't read them into the hearing here, we to date identified 54 acts of federal legislation which quite clearly discriminate against same-sex couples, and that there is no recognition of the rights of same-sex couples at all. It's not, we don't believe it's an exhaustive list, but that's what we've come up with to date. And most of those are relating to financial and entitlements and benefits. One of the areas we've looked at is superannuation. And in relation to that, in 2005, the Australian government did amend a number of superannuation laws to provide some parity for same-sex couples and some other close interdependent relationships. Again, it's not recognition of same-sex couples as a relationship in any way similar to marriage or even granted civil union status, but as part of a number of interdependent relationships which were then listed. What these amendments did was recognise that such that close personal relationships such as those, that the surviving dependent person on death would receive the so-called death benefit with the same tax exemption status, which is applicable to de facto or married couples, heterosexual couples. But it hasn't provided treatment for same-sex couples and other interdependent relationships, which is actually equal to that granted to heterosexual couples. Some of the problems are the definitions of interdependent relationship, which were placed into the legislation, are at odds with other federal legislation, such as the Migration Act for one, and certainly at odds with broader defined state definitions, state-based legislation. And this definition, the definition as it applies within superannuation law, still requires cohabitation by those same-sex couples, and they have to be able to prove that. And that's not something which is a burden of proof which is placed upon heterosexual couples, that they cohabit. This can mean that where same-sex couples are forced to live apart for quite serious reasons, it may be through work relocation, it could be through military service, sickness, frailty, or institutionalisation, then they cease to qualify for that recognition under the superannuation law. Again, and as was, I think, mentioned by an earlier speaker, there is another anomaly which occurs because none of those changes to superannuation laws apply to federal government employees, and there are a number of different pieces of federal government superannuation schemes in which those changes have absolutely no bearing, and there is still no recognition of same-sex couples. This can result in same-sex couples paying a 30% rate of taxation for benefits under federal government superannuation schemes, which heterosexual couples are not forced, do not have to pay. And that relates not only to federal government employees, but also those employed under territory laws in the ACT and Northern Territory, and to some members of the Defence Force. There's also superannuation code contribution laws. There was a change in 2005 which allows heterosexual relationships the ability to make superannuation. You're right, Grant.
Yep, I'll survive, I think.
Good, I'm glad. Which allows them to make superannuation co-contributions to each other's superannuation funds, and it gains them beneficial taxation treatments, but same-sex couples are unable to do that. Mm. And again, and I have to admit this is an area I'm not incredibly clear on, is the superannuation splitting rules on dissolution of relationships. Like many pieces of legislation, it ignores same-sex couples. It's come back to me. The family court can divide superannuation funds when relationships break down for heterosexual couples, but this does not recognise same-sex couples in any way. So they are then forced to go to the Supreme Court in quite an adversarial situation to have those decisions made. And it also includes tax rebates for a spouse making a superannuation contribution on behalf of a low-income or non-working partner, which is, again, not available to same-sex couples. Now, before I... the Defence Force is another area where there are some glaring things. There have been some improvements. Up until recently, when some policy changes were made, there was a Defence Force member who, when being transferred to the other side of the country, found that he could get his furniture moved, have his dog and his budgerigar moved, but in fact they would not move his partner of some 16 years, I think it was. So the budgie was okay and the dog was okay, but certainly not his partner. And that has there have been some changes in policy matters, internal policy matters, where the Defence Force has been able to set regulations. But there have been to date no changes in legislation dealing with Australian Defence Force personnel. Again, there are problems with Defence Force policy. There are problems around the issues of the definition of interdependency. And again, it requires the person to be in close personal relationship where there is both financial and cohabitation commitments. My understanding is that if, for instance, a Defence Force member in a same-sex relationship is sent on overseas duty, that the mere fact that that person is sent on overseas duty and their partner is left here behind in Australia means that they are no longer meeting the definition of interdependency because they're not living together. So unless they both happen to be serving members who get sent to the same part of Iraq, then they cease to exist as a couple for the purposes of Defence Force regulations. There are a number of areas in which, despite those positive changes that have taken place in relation to defence housing, housing removal and relocation, there are a number of areas in the Defence Force which can only achieve parity and equal rights with legislation. And these affect areas such as housing loans, superannuation, retirement benefits and death benefits for current and former personnel, as well as rehabilitation and compensation. So while the ADF now recognises close personal relationships under some operational policies, the federal government's refusal to make any legislative changes to date means that these relationships don't benefit from any of those, many of those areas which are pursuant to legislation. And I'm starting to ramble here. Okay, and superannuation schemes for ADF personnel just discriminate in a similar way to all other federal government employees. In which same-sex partners and other interdependent persons aren't recognised for taxation relief in relation to death benefit payouts. Okay, and then again there's benefits for former service personnel and veterans, in which a similar problem has also arisen, where same-sex couples again aren't treated equally under legislation. And this results in relation to these benefits in same-sex couples being recognised partially while in active service, but not recognised after the service ends. A particular note here is the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Committee, in the case of Young versus Australia, determined that Australia was in breach of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights because it denied both a pension and a bereavement payment to Edward Young, who'd been in a 38-year relationship with Larry Cairns when Larry Cairns died in 1998. This ruling found broadly that Australian law discriminates against same-sex couples and violates the right of everyone to equal treatment by the law. Rectification of veterans' benefits will result in Australia complying with international human rights obligations as it should, and will remove those anomalies. However, to date, the government has not yet, in fact, settled on the Young matter.
That's right.
Yeah, it hasn't to date. I just wanted to check on that because that was my memory.
That's right,
but yeah, I think the commissioner mentioned yesterday another interesting case where Mr. Hiro Takamasawa, a Japanese man who'd been in a 20-year relationship here in Australia with another veteran, John George. John George died, and his last name is Saha, Takamasawa, applied for a widow's pension and for a veteran, I'm not sure the full term there, the partner of a former serving member of the armed forces, and was granted one on the basis of the fact that somebody in the Department of Veterans Affairs thought the name Euro must have been that of a woman. And it wasn't until Mr. Takamasawa advised, because the correspondence was arriving addressed to Ms. Takamo Soa, and he advised them, no, he was in fact male at that time. They sent a courier around to pick up his gold card and cancel his entitlements. At this point, I'm going to pass this document over to Jen, and Jen will in fact carry on with some other areas.
Yeah.
At the end of it all, Rodney is going to cover some of the issue of marriage and some other issues that have come up along the way.
Okay. Thanks, Martin. It's brilliant. Thank you. Jen?
The first section I'm going to talk about is medical and aged care. In 2003-2004, Howard government made some changes to the Medicare and PBS safety nets, granting greater concessions for couples and families. There are two Medicare safety nets, one for out-of-pocket medical expenses and one for the gap between the cost of medical service and the Medicare scheduled fee. The PBS safety net exists to help individuals and families by heavily discounting prescriptions once their threshold has been reached. As part of this legislation, both Medicare and PBS safety nets contain definitions of what couples and family groups for registration under each safety net scheme are. The definitions contained in these sections of legislation, however, do not recognise same-sex couples for the safety nets. This creates an anomaly where a couple with or without children cannot register as a complete family, so obviously they're financially disadvantaged by this situation. So it means that a same-sex couple has two separate safety net thresholds in each safety net system, since neither system allows them to jointly register as a family unit. Secondly, Medicare and PBS expenses of the same couple are split between the two separate thresholds in each system and make it harder to reach the two separate thresholds. This imposes extra financial burdens on same-sex couples that heterosexual couples don't face, due to their unitary thresholds, with all family members' expenses contributing to reach that one threshold in each safety net. Aged care and nursing home care subsidies are another area. The Aged Care Act does not recognise same-sex couples as couples or partners. Under the legislation, this results in a person in a same-sex relationship having 100% of their individual assets utilised for assessment criteria rather than 50% of the joint assets of the relationship. This is especially problematic when same-sex couples own assets jointly and invariably results in a person in a same-sex relationship qualifying for less financial assistance under the residential care subsidy scheme. Recognising same-sex couples under the Aged Care Act would provide consistent asset assessment regime for both same-sex couples and heterosexual couples under the Act and remove financial hardship experienced by elderly same-sex couples. The Residential Aged Care Codes of Practice. Councils on the Ageing and National Seniors Association in their national policy document recommended that the federal government incorporate into their code of practice for residential aged care facilities be provided for couples, including same-sex couples, requiring different levels of nursing care to enable them to remain together and care for each other in the same establishment should they choose. Providing residential care supportive of same-sex couples remaining together allows such couples the same dignity and respect as heterosexual couples in comparable situations, with a failure to amend the federal government code of practice ensuring the continuation of negative outcomes for elderly same-sex couples in comparison to their heterosexual counterparts. Personally, I could think of nothing worse than, you know, in your old age being separated from your partner of many years in an aged care facility. I mean, some aged care facilities may be sympathetic, but without the legislative change, the ones that aren't, you could be separate, and that would be awful. Taxation. Australians' taxation laws have various offsets and deductions to assist taxpayers in their individual and family situations. Families receive numerous tax offsets and benefits to help ease the financial burden of raising a family or having a dependent. A dependent of an individual includes their spouse, which is defined as a heterosexual partner only. Other dependents include children under 16 or under 25 if a full-time student, the parents of the individual or their spouse, an invalid sibling or child. Because same-sex couples are not recognised as each other's spouse, an individual cannot treat the children or parents of their same-sex partner as their dependents. Therefore, they are denied various taxation benefits and concessions heterosexuals can utilise to help defray the costs of dependent partners, children and parents. For the same reason, an individual cannot treat the children or parents of their same-sex partner as their dependents. This means they are denied various taxation benefits and concessions heterosexuals take for granted. For an example, an individual in a same-sex relationship cannot claim the newly proposed 30% childcare rebate if the childcare costs relating to their partner's children or the spouse's parent tax offset for their same-sex partner's dependent parents, dependent on them. I'm not sure if that made any sense. Currently up to, $1,414 per parent per year. So they're out of pocket, over $1,000. Neither can the individual claim their same-sex partner under the dependent spouse tax offset worth up to $1,572 a year. So as you can see, the taxation department, their regulations and legislation mean that same-sex couples are out of pocket. Social Security. Since Centrelink legislation defines a couple as a heterosexual, same-sex relationships are not recognised in determining eligibility for benefits from the agency. This results in some financial benefits for same-sex couples. For myself and my team, she's on Newstart and she can claim that, and my income is not taken into account. I'm not considered to be her partner. They don't want to know. And, but in some ways you feel as though you're almost being dishonest, and it's horrible not to have your relationship recognised. So, under some benefits, individuals in same-sex relationships don't have their income or assets tested. A partner's situation may reduce or eliminate the benefit. This may result in increased benefits compared with some similar heterosexual couple. However, heterosexual couples are advantaged by higher combined assets test limits. This can assist heterosexual couples with unequal distribution of assets to still qualify for some payments. Since same-sex couples are not treated this way, it may disadvantage or disqualify a same-sex partner with large assets from a benefit. The greatest discrimination for same-sex couples comes with the death of a partner. For many Centrelink payments, a surviving heterosexual may be paid a lump sum continuing bereavement payment for up to 14 weeks, but the same-sex couple or partner would not be entitled to that payment. In addition to the above, because their relationship is not recognised, the surviving member of a same-sex couple doesn't qualify for a widow's pension or payments. The pain suffered from the loss of a same-sex partner is the same as that of a heterosexual partner, and the bereavement benefits should be equal to those available to heterosexuals. And that's it from me. Okay. Hi, Mr. Croom.
Would you like?
Thanks, Tim.
Miss Deb, okay. Thanks very much, Jen.
My contribution this morning will be to talk to generally to Tasmanian issues specific to Tasmanian law. Jen and Martine have already filled us in on many issues that relate to federal law, but of course one of the terms of reference of the inquiry is also continuing discrimination against same-sex couples in state law. So first of all, in that regard, I'll move us away slightly from issues of financial entitlements for same-sex couples to the issue of parenting for same-sex couples. Now, in 2003, as the inquiry would be aware, many Tasmanian laws were reformed to give equality to same-sex relationships in state law in many of the areas that we've been talking about. That legislative change was part of the Tasmanian Relationships Act, which came into force at the beginning of 2004. But there are outstanding areas of discrimination in state law that weren't adequately dealt with in that legislation, and they relate, as I said, to the area to the issue of parenting. There are two items in particular, one of more relevance to the inquiry than the other. The first item of lesser relevance is that same-sex couples in Tasmania are still not permitted to put themselves forward to be assessed as potential adoptive parents for children relinquished by other people. They can put themselves forward to be assessed as potential adoptive parents for children that they already care for, which was an important step forward. But of course, as I said, discrimination still remains in the area of stranger adoption. Of more relevance to this inquiry is that it is in relation to presumptive parenting. It's still the case in Tasmania that children born to a woman in a same-sex relationship as a result of artificial reproductive technology, where there's no known father, cannot be presumed to be the child of that woman's same-sex partner. Children born to women who are in heterosexual relationships, either married or de facto, will be presumed to be the child of the de facto or married partner of their mother. That is the male partner of their mother. But, like I said, if the woman is in a same-sex relationship, then that presumptive parenting doesn't apply. The relevance to the inquiry is that this can have serious financial and legal implications for the child and for the mother, which is important to note. There has been an inquiry into this issue in Tasmania subsequent to the passage of the Relationships Act in 2003. The inquiry was conducted by the Parliamentary Community Development Committee. The Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group put in a submission to that inquiry. There were quite a few other submissions. And the inquiry, the Community Development Committee, as a part of this inquiry, recommended that there should be recognition of presumptive parenthood for same-sex couples in the circumstances that I outlined. And I'll just take one quote from their final report, which illustrates the points that I'm talking about. The quote is from Kristen Walker, who is an associate professor of law at Melbourne University. "The law should recognise the child's actual family circumstances. For children born through fertilisation procedures to women in same-sex relationships, this means the possibility of having two legal parents rather than one. If the law does not recognise the child's actual family circumstances, the child is disadvantaged legally, financially, socially and emotionally. Their parents are also disadvantaged by not having the role of the non-biological mother recognised in law. For example, the child will not automatically inherit from his or her non-biological mother, nor from his or her non-biological grandparents or other relatives. Further, ability to provide medical care for the child may be compromised if one parent is unable to consent because she is not legally acknowledged as a parent and the legally recognised mother is unavailable. Now, what we will do is provide the hearing, provide the inquiry, sorry, with a copy of both our submission to that inquiry and also the inquiry's final report.
Thank you.
So that you'll be able to see the context in which this issue exists in Tasmania, the legal context, and also the ramifications legally and financially for families headed by same-sex couples in Tasmania of this outstanding discrimination. And it's because of those legal and financial ramifications that I raise it today. I think that it is important that we realise that discrimination against same-sex couples not only affects the partners involved, but also their families, and including their children. So in terms of continuing discrimination in Tasmanian law, that was one issue that we wanted to raise, and probably the most important one. The other Tasmanian issue that we wanted to talk about today, of course, was the existence in Tasmania of a relationship registry. The relevance of this to the terms of reference of the inquiry is that having a way to certify one's relationship officially has major ramifications for access to the kinds of financial and workplace entitlements that are the subject of the inquiry, the current inquiry. Jen and Martine have outlined the kind of discrimination which continues in federal law. Obviously, we believe very passionately that that discrimination should be removed. But then the next question becomes, in what way should it be removed? How can we address this discrimination? And of course, the question that arises then is, or the possible answers to that question are, by recognising same-sex couples as equivalent to de facto heterosexual couples, or recognising them as interdependents, or recognising them through some kind of relationship registration system, some kind of nomination scheme. Now, in Tasmania, we have a system where same-sex relationships are recognised both presumptively, that is, as interdependents, or in traditional language, de facto style relationships. They're presumed, same-sex partners are presumed to be in a relationship if they fulfil certain criteria. And we also allow, through our relationship registry, those couples to nominate, officially put themselves forward as being in a couple, to nominate themselves as being in a couple, and therefore to receive those rights, the same rights as married and de facto heterosexual couples. It's our firm belief that at a national level, couples should have the same options. They should have the option to be presumed to be in a relationship in the same way as de facto heterosexual couples are, or the right to nominate themselves as being in a relationship, to put themselves forward and say, yes, we are in a relationship that should be recognised, and then to receive rights. The advantage, of course, of having that second tier of recognition, the ability for couples to nominate themselves, is twofold. Firstly, it means that they don't have to jump the hurdles which are put before de facto couples. If you are to qualify to be in a de facto relationship, you need to fulfil certain criteria, such as certain cohabitation period. In some jurisdictions, you need to show that you're in a sexual relationship, or at least in an emotionally and financially interdependent relationship. With a nomination scheme or a certification scheme similar to the one we have in Tasmania, it's not necessary for couples to jump those hurdles. They simply say, yes, we are a couple. They fill out the requisite paperwork, they receive a certificate, and they are therefore in an officially recognised relationship and receive the same rights and responsibilities as married or de facto couples in state law. We believe the same, again, should apply at a national level. The other advantage of the kind of certification or nomination scheme I'm talking about is, as we've already heard this morning, the ability to prove your relationship status if you're challenged. This is particularly important for partners in non-traditionally recognised relationships, relationships that traditionally have had no legal status and may still be socially stigmatised, including same-sex relationships. If we're in partners are in situations, for instance, where, as we've already heard, one partner takes ill and is in hospital, and the hospital authorities or the biological family of the sick partner challenge the right of the other partner to access hospital access, or the right for them to be involved in medical decision making, then it can be difficult for them to prove their relationship status. If they have put themselves forward through an official nomination and certification scheme, like the one we have in Tasmania, if they have that certificate to prove their relationship status, then that eliminates the dispute. So for those two reasons, because official relationship recognition provides immediate access to spousal rights, and also because it provides proof of the status of a relationship, we're firmly of the belief that there needs to be some way for same-sex couples to prove their relationship status, to be able to nominate themselves or certify themselves as being in a relationship. Now, one traditional way, of course, that everyone's familiar with is marriage. That is basically a form of relationship recognition and registration, albeit one with a great deal of elaboration. The Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group, obviously, as you can see in our submission, supports equal rights for same-sex couples in the institution of marriage. But we also acknowledge that there is still some opposition to the idea of same-sex marriage within the community, and certainly within the major political parties, and that a more acceptable way for couples to be able to nominate their relationships, to have them certified, and to be able to prove their relationship status would be a scheme similar to that in Tasmania. As we heard earlier from Jonathan Hodgkin, that scheme caused very little debate in Tasmania. It was generally accepted by people across the political spectrum and across the community. It had widespread support. It still has widespread support. We can't see any reason why, if that scheme works in Tasmania with popular support and parliamentary support, it couldn't also work nationally, to be able to provide same-sex couples and people in other significant personal relationships with an opportunity to certify that they're in a couple. So they're the two Tasmanian issues I wanted to raise today, the relationship registry and also parenting. And I'll just finish on two small points that relate to all of the issues that have been discussed by Jen and Martina and myself. The first is the issue of law reform and what happens when the laws change. Now, I've been a gay human rights advocate for many years now, and because of my profile, I guess, many people come to me when they experience problems with the law. I've had many people come to me over the years to experience to talk about the experiences they've had, often quite harrowing ones, with the discrimination that we've outlined today. Sadly, I've also had people come to me with harrowing stories about their relationships not being treated equally, even when laws and policies have been changed. And I'm talking here about laws at a state level and also laws at a federal level. I'm talking, for instance, about teachers who are unable to get carer's leave because their principals disagree with the fact that they're in a same-sex relationship, even though the policies and the legal regime in which they operate would give that same-sex couple equal entitlements as heterosexual relationships. I'm talking about managers within the Commonwealth Public Service who are not aware of law changes and enforce policies from 10 or 20 years ago. I'm talking about superannuation scheme managers who aren't aware that same-sex couples have the same entitlements as heterosexual couples in some schemes. So it's very much our recommendation that when law reform does occur, as we believe it inevitably will at a national level, that there's an education process for those relevant authorities, both government and non-government, to make them aware that the changes have occurred. And when they deliver these policy outcomes and services that they're responsible for, then the policies they enforce and the services they deliver are non-discriminatory, in line with the law reform that has occurred. I think we've learnt our lesson in Tasmania that law reform isn't enough, that there also needs to be education about the impact of that law reform. So when law reform occurs at a national level, that's what we'd like to see. And that's my, this will be my final point when it comes to change and law reform. In talking to many people in the gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender community over the last few days about this inquiry, the importance of this inquiry and the possibilities for change, I've encountered a disquieting level of disillusionment. People who feel that even though change is necessary, it may not occur. That even though they have experienced terribly harrowing situations themselves, they expect it to happen again. My response to them, or my first response to them is, well, things changed in Tasmania. If they can change in Tasmania, they can change anywhere. That cheers some people up, but not everyone. So for those who remain a bit resistant to my morale boosting, I cite another story. A story about the former president of the Tasmanian RSL, Ian Kennett. Ian is a Vietnam veteran, and like many Vietnam veterans, he is a fairly hard-nosed kind of guy. He's seen a lot of things, and he's not necessarily, you know, he can be hardened to the problems of the world. But in his role as RSL president, he encountered quite a few members of the ADF from Tasmania who were in same-sex relationships, encountered the problems they were having with issues like relocation and on and off base accommodation and superannuation and all the rest. And he was really moved by what he heard, by what they told him. He was particularly moved because these people were, in his estimation, the very best soldiers, immensely professional, sacrificing so much for their country and yet not being treated equally, certainly not being treated the same as their heterosexual counterparts. And he just, having been in a war zone himself, he just felt it was immensely unfair and also bad for the ADF to have soldiers fighting next to each other, shoulder to shoulder, but not being treated equally, and some knowing that their spouses back home would be protected if they were wounded or killed, and others knowing that they wouldn't. So he took the issue up within the RSL, raised it in the RSL National Executive. As you might expect, some people in the RSL, some other people in the RSL were very sceptical about the issue. They derided him, they ridiculed him. Others could see that he had a point. He raised it again and again and again, until finally the RSL recognised that this was a serious issue, not just for individual service personnel, but for the armed forces as a whole. He persuaded the RSL National Committee to support recognising same-sex relationships in the kinds of areas which we've talked about today. The RSL went to the Prime Minister, this is according to Ian, went to the Prime Minister, expressed their concern, and many of the problems that we've talked about, many of the aspects of discrimination that we've cited, were removed. Now, of course, there's still outstanding discrimination in the ADF, but some of those really difficult issues like relocation and on and off base accommodation, they were rectified. A story like that gives me great hope. If someone like Ian Kennett can persuade his colleagues to make representations to our Prime Minister, and the result is important change, then, as with Tasmania, if that can happen, anything can change. Thank you.
Thank you, Rodney, Martine and Jen. Can I just ask you a couple of questions? You discuss issues of recognition of some rights under state laws which are then not recognised at a federal level in your submission. You, for example, you talk about the Relationships Act allowing the adoption of an individual's child by their same-sex partner. And you say that this contrast of recognition and non-recognition creates a number of anomalies. Can you take us through examples of such anomalies or which this conflict causes?
Well, as you've said, one example that we cite is where, for the purposes of state law, a child who is adopted by a same-sex couple through our known child provisions, so this is the child the couple already cares for, the couple adopts the child. In Tasmanian law, that child is recognised as the child of both those people. They're both that child's parents. So when it comes to issues like next of kin, medical decision making, inheritance, the issues that were cited by Chris Walker in the quote that I gave you earlier, then that child has complete legal security because those are issues of state law. But when it comes to federal taxes, to Medicare and the Medicare rebate, the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, Centrelink, if those people are in the ADF, I've already mentioned some of the issues there, and of course most crucially when it comes to the Family Law Act, because that's Commonwealth law, that child is not recognised as the child of both parents. If only one, if the, one of them is a biological parent, or perhaps of neither, if they've been adopted as a relative. So that's one of the anomalies that struck us as most significant. We've already heard this morning as well about how the failure to recognise Tasmanian registered relationships in federal law can create ridiculous situations where foreign governments recognise same-sex relationships in Tasmania, but our national government doesn't. In that regard, I'll just point out that it's not only Britain which recognises Tasmanian registered relationships, they're also recognised in Canada and New Zealand. But they're not recognised, so you can go across the Tasman Sea or across the Pacific Ocean and have them recognised. If you go across Bass Strait, you cease to be in a legally recognised relationship as soon as you get to Wilson's Promontory. Not only is it not a Tasmanian registered relationship not recognised in federal law, it's not recognised in any other state law, which really is an absurd and quite demeaning situation for those couples. The same problems exist in other states where there's recognition of same-sex couples in state law but not federal law, and particularly, and that can be particularly difficult, like I said, when you're dealing with parenting. This situation also applies in, when it comes to parenting, to the ACT and to Western Australia. There's less recognition of same-sex couple parenting in the other jurisdictions, but inevitably that will change.
Okay, thank you. If you were asked to advise any other Australian state to amend their laws to remove discrimination against same-sex couples in the area that this inquiry is covering, I think you perhaps already covered this, but would you recommend copying the Tasmanian laws, or are there still aspects of the laws that you think could be improved, and what would they be?
Well, I've cited, obviously, continued discrimination in parenting, so I wouldn't want anyone to copy that. In terms of the overall structures that we have in Tasmanian law now regarding relationships and their recognition, I'd say yes, it is a very good model. It's a good model because it treats all relationships equally. apart from the little aspects of discrimination I've mentioned, which can hopefully be eliminated in the future, whether we're talking about married heterosexual relationships, de facto heterosexual relationships, same-sex relationships, or non-conjugal relationships, that is, relationships between older companions or carers and the people they care for, they're all treated virtually equally. They all have similar rights and responsibilities under state law, and of course they all have the opportunity, except married couples, because they don't need it, they've got their certificate, they all have the same opportunity to nominate themselves, put themselves forward and have their relationship registered. So if we're to follow through the principles of anti-discrimination and equality and justice for all, then I'd say the Tasmanian relationship scheme is a very good model to build on. It is based on those principles. It doesn't privilege any kind of relationship over another. It doesn't say marriage is better or de facto is better. It says everyone has the right to be either presumed to be in a relationship or to nominate themselves to be in a relationship, and everyone will be treated equally based on those choices. So yes, I think we'd recommend the Tasmanian scheme as something which would work in other states and also definitely work at a national level. Having said that, we don't want to give the impression that the Tasmanian scheme, for instance, should be seen as a substitute for marriage. The institution of marriage remains important to many people. It remains important to many heterosexual couples and same-sex couples that they have the right to marry. And so in regards to marriage, we would say that there should be equality for same and opposite-sex couples. And of course, like I've already said, marriage remains a way for couples to access the kind of spousal entitlements that we've been talking about today immediately and without the need to fulfil criteria, the criteria that will jump the hurdles that de facto couples need to do. We're not saying marriage is better as a way of recognising same-sex couple spousal entitlements, nor is it worse. It should simply be another option amongst many for, that people have before them to choose how their relationships are recognised or if their relationships are recognised. Choice and equality, they're the basic principles.
Okay, well, thank you all for those for both the submission and for appearing this morning. That's been very helpful to the inquiry, and we appreciate the contribution that you've made.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you.